2016 is the centennial year of the Pulitzer Prize. The honor has been awarded to dozens of people from or living in Georgia. And so we'll spend some time with past winners all year long. It's a new series we're calling Pulitzer Peaches. Today we revisit my conversation with author Alice Walker. Her rural upbringing in Eatonton has had a heavy influence on her writing. She became the first African-American woman to win the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1983 for her novel, The Color Purple. I spoke with her back in October when she was in Georgia. Here's an excerpt from that conversation. It is a real honor to welcome you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for asking me.
I think that many people who love your work, and I have to imagine that's the way, as an artist and a writer, that's the way most people, general people, know you, although you're incredibly active and have always been in activism. I think people sometimes forget your history as part of the civil rights movement, which goes back to your days as a student at Spelman. Can you explain to me what that path was like? And what I mean by that is, at the same time that you're learning how to become a novelist and a writer, you're also focusing a great deal of attention on activism. You're taking time off to lead voter registration drives. Were those two separate paths, the art and the activism?
Well, no, you have to understand that if you're going to be an artist, you need to, for instance, be able to make a living. And if you can't make a living except doing, you know, chores that were specifically designed for just black people, then that is not, you know, that's not a good thing. So you have to go against the culture that is actually forcing you to do things that are likely to make it impossible for you to be an artist. So, for instance, one of the things that still prevailed when I was growing up was that I couldn't try on a dress in a store, you know, on the main street. And that could really upset your whole life, not to mention the day, you know, that your mother brought you into the store.
So let me take you back then, since you mentioned growing up. I read one place where you said you had to hide your writing from your family. You started writing when you were about 8 years old?
Sometime early, yeah.
Why did you keep that secret?
Well, when you grow up in a family of, you know, lots of people.
Yeah, you were the youngest of eight, right?
Seven brothers and sisters. And a very, very, very small house and very little paper. So it was better to keep things from my two brothers. Who were very likely to, you know, want to intrude and read and laugh and whatever. So I learned to write in my head much more than on paper for many, many, many years. And in fact, I almost never did drafts until quite late in my writing life. I preferred to compose things almost entirely in my head and then write once and that would probably be it. But it would take a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine. Do you think that has, in the end, affected your writing style?
I don't know. I mean, I would imagine everything you do affects, you know, what you produce.
Yeah.
But it helped me because it saved a lot of trees. And I was glad of that because I always loved trees. And I just liked the reality that people, human beings, are so beautifully made that we can hold an awful lot in the mind and work on things in the mind, and you know, and there's a freedom to that, so that often you can just avoid a lot of things that are going on around you because you have a world that is full in your own imagination.
I wanted to ask you about Zora Neale Hurston, who seems to have been a constant influence for you. And I mean, people said that you almost single-handedly rescued her from obscurity. You went and actually found her gravesite back in the 70s. You've had a link with her most of your life. What draws you to her?
Because I didn't have a link. She died when I was a junior in high school. And I had no clue that she'd even existed when I went away to college in at Sarah Lawrence in New York. My teacher had known her, but never mentioned her. And her name was in the first book I was published in, but because, you know, at that time we thought only the men were writers, I never even noticed. And so years later, when I discovered that she had existed, that she'd written Their Eyes Were Watching God, and I adored it, I couldn't believe how she had been so, forgotten by people who had known her and so ignored. And then to discover that she'd also been vilified and very badly treated. So, yes, I loved her so much, and I went to Florida, and I found the only sunken place in this huge field that could have been her grave, and that was, you know, a wonderful thing for me. I felt, that was something that she really deserved. And now people love her, and they go there by the thousands every year.
You know, I wonder, Zora Neale Hurston could have been a cautionary tale if you had seen her that way, in terms of being careful about the way that your activism and your political voice may influence the way people see you and treat you. And I wonder if you ever thought about that. You've been so active all your life. And you have never shied away from putting that into your novels and your poems and all of the other writing that you do. Did it ever concern you that it might affect the way that you were treated, or whether you were published, or the way you were reviewed?
Oh, well, yes, and it has of course affected everything my whole life. But what you learn is that it is such a joy to be able to speak what you see and to share what you know, that is worth the consequences. So I've always felt that. And I think she did too. I mean, in her case, it was to show the beauty of African-American Southern culture. And she was going to do that whether people liked it or didn't like it or whatever they had to say about her. She paid the price, and I think you just have to be willing to accept that whatever other people do is their business. You know, your business is what the mission that you're on, and it's not something that's negotiable, really. I mean, it's just who you are and what you are put here to do.
So, in your book, Possessing the Secret of Joy, since we're talking about joy here, this is a book that's it's difficult to read, and I don't mean the writing itself is difficult. It's that you are talking about the issue, the practice of female genital mutilation, in parts of Africa and the Middle East and other places, and you do not shy away at all from graphic depictions. It's a beautiful book. But it's hard for me to imagine how you came at the beauty and the language with such a topic. And I wonder if you said you don't write drafts, but do you go back and on a book like that to make sure of where that line is?
Oh, yeah. No. By then, I was doing drafts. I was just explaining that in the beginning, I didn't do many drafts because I had learned to be very careful of people intruding, and also we didn't have a lot of money to spend on paper. But no, of course, as I went along, I could afford paper, and I could afford drafts, and I could throw things in the waste paper basket. But yeah, with that particular book, it's just that I love little girls. I love children, and I couldn't imagine. I learned about this when I was in Kenya. When I was, in my 20s, I guess. And it was so shocking that I just hid it from myself for decades. I couldn't imagine what I could do or if anybody could do this, because we're talking about millions of children. And so I worried it and worried it for a long time. And then I realized that it was obviously something that I had been trained to do, to write about this. My background was so poor and so hard, and yet somehow my parents and my community had sent me off, and I had become educated and I could write, and then the universe had said, well, here, look at this. And so it was clear to me that you know, I was there. I had the tools, and I should do this work. And I did it, and I'm very glad. I know a lot of people have been very unhappy. And, you know, I've heard from a couple of the surgeons who do this in hospitals in the West, for instance, in London and New York and, you know, other places, which, you know, is shocking enough.
Yeah.
But they, you know, they have thought that instead of doing it in an unhygiene way, we should do it, you know, hygienically in our hospital, as if that helps the child later on who has to grow into an adult who has to deal with the consequences of being mutilated in this way.
You know, a lot of scholars say that novel, Possessing the Secret of Joy, is part of a trilogy with The Temple of My Familiar and The Color Purple. And I wonder if that's how you intend... I mean, scholars are writing about them that way, but I wonder if that's how you intended them.
No, I don't believe in sequels, and I don't believe in trilogies for myself. Other people could have them. But no, I mean, it you know, the characters sometimes are, you know, Tashi is in... On one page.
Tashi's the African wife of Seeley's son from the novel Possessing the Secret of
Joy.
Right. Yeah.
But you know, this is her story, and it's not really... But on the other hand, if people want to read it that way, I really don't mind. I mean, read it however you'd like. But I don't... you know, I remember when we made the movie of The Color Purple, and they were wondering and wanting a sequel... and I said, absolutely not. I mean, I don't want any spinoffs. I don't want, you know, to wake up one day and have, you know, some crazy, idiotic sentences coming out of anybody else's mouth. Seeley's or Suge's or Sophia's or Mister's. It would be horrendous. Because each work comes as a whole, complete thing itself. And you don't have any plots and plans, I mean, at least I don't, for trying to spin it off into something else. I have to be really drawn to each individual subject and each situation, and then I give it my full attention for a couple of years.
Now, you've described yourself as a womanist as opposed to a feminist. What does that mean? What's the difference?
Well, I'm an African-American. My adventure, and actually it has been an adventure, but... reality here in the United States is very different from that of a white person or a white woman. So, you know, there is feminism, which is a valid thing, and I am fine to be a feminist, but womanism means that I incorporate and that I stand firmly in my tradition as an African-American woman and what that has meant.
Is that a response? There has been a lot of complaints from women of color that the feminist movement, the new feminist movement, is a largely white female movement and is sometimes insensitive and sometimes openly aggressive to the struggles of women of color. Is that part of what you're responding to?
Well, I think the truth is really that. What we're seeing is something that has been going on all the time, is that, generally speaking, I think many white feminists have seen the struggle to be equal with the white man, and that is to basically, you know, be a bit above everybody else as a couple. And this is the history, you know, I mean, that is just the reality. And I think many women of color and other, you know, women in the world have assumed that feminism meant that your loyalty would be to all the women of the planet. It wouldn't be to, you know, marry the top guy and then rule over everybody else. But what seems to be, you know, somewhat unsettling is the notion that the white woman who comes to consciousness about her own, you know, inequality because she's female is actually wanting just to be equal with the man who's on top, i.e. the white man, and therefore not loyal to the other women of the planet, and in fact often is detrimental to them. For instance, in the government, where often white women who come to power don't seem to be all that conscious that the countries that they, you know, talk about bombing are full of women. You know, they are full of women and children. So what kind of feminism is that? You know, I mean, to be consciously aware of women and children would mean that you would not say, as Hillary did at some point, we will obliterate Iran. You can't talk about obliterating, you know, a country and all the people and still say you are a feminist. I mean, what are you talking about?
Alice Walker, such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was my conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning author Alice Walker. I spoke with her back in October.